Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges and I'll be with you over the next half hour. Coming up on today's program, the Pope and the People. We have a report on Pope Francis's Wednesday General Audience, where he spoke of how faith is not an ideology or philosophy, but springs from the events surrounding Christ's resurrection. How to revitalize the Church. The author of a just published book in the US talks to us about how every baptized Catholic can work to reinvigorate the institutional Church. And the voice of the Polish Pope. As the Church marks Divine Mercy Sunday, we look back at the figure of Pope St. John Paul II, who instituted this feast. We begin our programme with a report on Pope Francis's Wednesday General Audience, where he spoke of how faith is not an ideology or philosophy, but instead springs from the events surrounding Christ's resurrection. In his catechesis, the Pope reflected on how our faith was born with the risen Jesus on Easter morning and said a closed or rationalistic heart cannot understand what is Christianity. Philippa Hitchin reports.
Cari fratelli e sorelle, buongiorno.
Reflecting on the words of St. Paul to the early Christian community in Corinth, the Pope said Jesus himself is our hope, and his resurrection is the event that grounds our faith. Without it, he said, Christianity would be a mere human philosophy, and Jesus would simply be another great religious figure.
Paolo fa un elenco delle persone.
Pope Francis said our belief is based on the testimony of those who encountered the risen Christ, from St. Peter and the group of 12 disciples to St. Paul, who was converted by his dramatic meeting with the Lord on the road to Damascus. The Pope said that encountering Christ in faith is always a surprise. It is a grace given to those whose hearts are open. It overturns our comfortable existence and opens us to an unexpected future, sowing life and light in places of death and sorrow.
In questi giorni di Pasqua, portiamo questo grido nel cuore.
This is the reason for our Easter joy, the Pope said. In the risen Jesus who dwells in our midst, we encounter the power of God's love, which triumphs over death, bringing new life and undying hope. During this Easter season, he concluded, let us continue to cry from our hearts that Jesus is risen and lives among us here today. I'm Philippa Hitchin.
Latest statistics released by the Vatican concerning the global number of Catholics paint a mixed picture. The figures show substantial growth in the numbers of both clergy and lay faithful in Africa and Asia, but declining vocations and mass attendance in other parts of the world. This decline has been going on for decades in many countries, and some analysts are warning that the Church requires some profound changes in strategy and leadership style to reverse this alarming trend. Chris Lowney is one of those Catholics who believe that Pope Francis's reform efforts must be followed up by a transformation of culture and participation from the grassroots through to the hierarchical level. A former Jesuit seminarian, Lowney became a successful banker and currently chairs the board of Catholic Health Initiatives, one of America's biggest hospital systems. He talked to Philippa Hitchin about his latest book entitled Everyone Leads: How to Revitalize the Catholic Church. He told her that Catholics need to be much more frank and forthright about some of the challenges facing the Church and stressed that everybody really has to play a role in doing something about them.
Your latest book is called Everyone Leads: How to Revitalize the Catholic Church. Just give us an idea as to the background of this book, where the idea came from.
The shortest version would be that the book is a call to action. I'm a lifelong Catholic, delighted to be a Catholic, but it's also struck me that we have to be much more frank and forthright about some of the challenges we have, and accept the fact that everybody really has to play a role in doing something about them. And we have to have a culture that enables that and a culture where people feel some responsibility.
You're talking about challenges. You actually describe this as the biggest crisis in the last five centuries, don't you?
Yes. And I know that's a very provocative idea. And, you know, look, I'm not a bomb thrower from an ideological wing of the church, but I really was challenging people to think about some of these numbers. For example, you know, in the United States, but in many, many countries, you look at young adults, very, very small interest in organized religion in the Catholic Church. You look at sacramental participation, numbers going down for decades in many countries. You look in many countries and people who are baptized, their willingness even to call themselves Catholic, dropping in many countries. And to me, when we put all of these things together, I think it's worth saying, okay, please think about a time when we've had to struggle with a constellation, a combination of challenges this great, you know? And I know when we use the word crisis, people think, oh, there's an earthquake, that's a crisis, and we fix it and it goes on. But in some ways, I think the more debilitating, the more harmful crises are somehow silent. Like, we walk around, we go to church, it's fine. People don't feel that there's a crisis. And I think in some ways, those are the most deadly because you can ignore them.
You're talking about these numbers from a very Western perspective. As you mentioned in the book, it's not like that in Africa or Asia where numbers are growing.
Yes, and that's a very fair comment. And, you know, one of the things I mention in the book is I could write 10 books on everything that's positive and going well. And, you know, I myself have wonderful experiences in church and as part of the church, and I'm part of a big healthcare ministry. And you're completely right. You know, the story of the growth of the church in Africa especially is, you know, is almost beyond belief. More than 200% growth in just a few decades. And many pockets of Asia, we see the same. Lots of vocations coming out of Africa, India, many places. And those are all wonderful. And I don't mean to deny any of those. But I guess I would say this, that to me, we as a church, you know, have yet to prove that we can answer the challenges that come along with fully developed societies in modernity. You know, in developing settings like Africa, we're doing really well, and let's hope they have a secret to teach the rest of us. But I think we only would know that for sure when we get to highly developed urban situations, you know, the kind of situations that have led folks in my United States, but in urban settings all across Europe, Australia, elsewhere, to turn away from organized religion and the church and to be more skeptical and postmodern.
So you're saying the crisis may yet happen in these other
places where
numbers are...
Exactly. And I'm not wishing that on anyone. I'm not trying to undercut the wonderful things that are going on there. But I'm just saying I really think it's inappropriate to sort of point to some of the places where things are going well and saying, okay, this guy is just a naysayer to talk about things in crisis. I really think that's a short-sighted and dangerous way for us as a church to think about our predicament.
As you say, this book is a call to action. What is the basis of this new strategy that you're calling for?
The most fundamental call, the most fundamental part of the new strategy is really the title, Everyone Leads, you know? And that's not the way people think in any organizations. My background is in banking, and, you know, you tend to think, oh, the chief executive is a leader and we're all followers. And that's true in the church as well, you know. We tend to think, oh, the Pope's the leader, or maybe the cardinal or bishop of my diocese. And there's many absolutely true ways in which that is true, and I'm not trying to undermine hierarchy or authority or roles. But I am saying this. For example, Pope Benedict XVI introduced this idea of everybody is co-responsible for the church. And when you think about a word like that, you know, if you're responsible for something, it means I understand what's going on. I feel some real ownership in the whole thing. I know that I have a real role in making it work. So to me, that's how I get to Everyone Leads, you know. And when you think of organizations, especially organizations with challenges now in the modern world, there's no organization, again, take my example of banking, that would believe that one executive or a small group of executives can show all the initiative, make all the decisions, come up with all the creative ideas to help the organization face its many, many challenges. And I think it's exactly the same for the Catholic Church.
To be fair, the idea of involving all lay people as well as just the leadership goes back half a century to the Second Vatican Council, and yet it has largely not taken place, this change in style, if you like, over the last 50 years. Why is that?
Yeah, without doubt, you know, you're right. And let me go back to my own United States. I recently saw some statistics that only about 30% of regular Massgoers, not like casual Catholics, only 30% of regular Massgoers in the U.S. would say that they understand well how to get involved in ministry. Only about half even feel invited. You know, and to me, based on what you just introduced about the Second Vatican Council, I mean, how could we possibly be in that predicament? But your question to me is, you know, why is it that way?
And it's all, you know, very well calling for it, but it doesn't seem to happen.
You know, I don't know. I mean, I suspect that's a really complicated question, you know. I mean, among the things I'd say is it's really hard to change culture. I know that coming from working in a plain old company that was 100 years old, we're in an institution that's 2,000 years old, you know, and I think it's hard to come to grips with just how deeply a culture can get entrenched. And our culture does have its sort of hierarchical aspects to it. You know, the Pope is the one who talks about clericalism as being a danger and a sin. And if we're not careful, that kind of thing can take root and, frankly, has taken root. That's not my word. This is what the Pope says. So, I think there's probably a constellation of reasons why it's been difficult for us to change our culture. And, frankly, that's part of the way why I started the book with some really forceful, difficult news, because often in organizations, they only change when people feel we can't keep going like this. You know, it's just not sustainable. And that was the reason why I started with some really frank, difficult news.
You mentioned Pope Francis, his criticism of the clerical culture, and I think many people would suggest that he is doing exactly what you're talking about, trying to change the strategy, the culture, and the leadership style.
It's my impression, too, you know, that that's absolutely right. And, you know, I think now part of our challenge is, okay, so what do we do? He's kind of made the call, but as I would see it, we haven't quite connected all the dots. You know, when you think about his approval rating, he's generated great goodwill, and that's really important for the church and for any organization. You know, that's an asset. But I don't know that we've quite connected the dots in terms of follow-through. You know, for example, levels of mass participation haven't really budged very much. So that's just one example. But, you know, how can we translate goodwill or his call to action to get some real traction on the ground? I think that's our challenge as a church overall. And I never pretend that I have the answers or the best answers. In a way, part of the idea of the book was to open a conversation. And to the question you ask, you know, so but the Pope has made the call, how do we take a step forward? It is very likely, I would say, that 100, 1,000 listeners right now would have one or two or five much better ideas than I would ever come up with. We just need to get better at making people feel encouraged and a responsibility to share those ideas and even to take some of those initiatives themselves.
You say you don't have all the answers, but you do have some quite specific practical suggestions, don't you, as how to do this, how to build on the kind of reforms that the Pope is exactly calling for?
Yes, I put out there a strategy for discussion. Okay, I'm a business person, so that's a kind of a frame that would come to my mind. And I call it an Easter strategy because everybody has to have an acronym so people will remember things. But of course, Easter is very fitting for us as Christians, as Catholics especially. The E and the A in some ways would be the cultural, you know, how we need to change our way of thinking and behaving. And E is for being more entrepreneurial. And when people hear that word, they think of, oh, let's start a business like Bill Gates, and that's in no way what I have in mind. I mean it in the sense of to be not just more creative in the sense of I design the parish bulletin differently, but more fundamentally creative, you know, more imaginative in terms of, is there a different way we could do this? And to be willing, and this may be the most important part, to be willing to take the risk of failure in trying new things. Again, I used the example of young adults before. And let's, in the United States, be frank enough to admit that we, in many ways, don't know how to engage young adults well. And to me, that's a perfect petri dish, you know, a perfect little laboratory for entrepreneurialism, for experimentation.
So E for entrepreneurial, A for?
And A for being accountable. And let me explain the idea of accountability in this way. I once remember a meeting where somebody new was hired and then introduced to a management team. And one of the guys on the management team said, you know, you're most welcome. Great to have you. Could you please come back in 3 months and just tell us, how will we know when you're successful? And to me, that was a great phrase and a great way to understand what I'm talking about when I say accountability. In other words, how do we know we're successful? You know, there are many things that we pledge and say are priorities for us as a church. For example, that when people come to Mass, that they would have a profound experience and ultimately, over time, a conversion of sorts, you know, that somehow they would be transformed. How do we know that's happening in our parishes? If we're not willing to ask the questions, you know, you come to this parish each week, how's it going? You know, are you growing in your spiritual life, stagnating, nothing's changing? And how have we done over time? Are we doing better this year than last year? So that would be an example of holding ourselves accountable.
So then you move on to S and T, service and transformation.
Yeah, and I point out that if you're a parish priest, you're a diocese, you're the Catholic Church, there are dozens, hundreds of things you have to do. And sometimes I think it helps to try to boil things down into a very manageable number of really important things that reflect what's essential. And for us, the way I described in the book, among the things that are essential for the Catholic Church is that we serve those who are poor and marginalized. The second, we have to transform people's lives. Those in the Catholic community would probably recognize the word conversion better. You know, I was trying to reach for a more general word than that. In other words, when people come, something is supposed to happen to them.
And finally, R, for reach out.
And we're going to have to reach out. You know, when I was a kid, we didn't have to reach out. Oh, I mean, I grew up in one of these great ethnic neighborhoods in New York City, all Irish and Italian Catholics. Kids were born, you brought them to church, they went to Catholic school, and they just kept coming. And those days are just over. Not in every country in the world, but in too many countries in the United States, Europe, Oceania, those days are over. You know, there are dozens of reasons, but the bottom line is we're going to have to reach out because people are not going to show up. And this, I think, is another theme that the Pope is really, really big on. He talks about this a lot.
That was U.S. Catholic author Chris Lowney speaking to Philippa Hitchin. The second Sunday of Easter is Divine Mercy Sunday in the Catholic liturgical calendar. Pope St. John Paul II was deeply devoted to the Divine Mercy and said it was the key to his entire pontificate. It was he who designated Divine Mercy Sunday as a special devotional practice for the Universal Church. In this special report by Veronica Scaresbrick, looking back at the figure of the Polish-born Pope, we dip into Vatican Radio's archives to bring you sound clips of him speaking in English.
I have called to you, Lord, hasten to help me. Hear my voice when I cry to you. To you, Lord God, my eyes are turned. In you I take refuge. Spare my soul.
I remember reading one of his friends, an intimate friend of his, a layman, who said that you don't understand the soul of John Paul II unless you realize he's a Carmelite at heart.
Being a Carmelite at heart referred to much more than Pope John Paul's special devotion to the great Carmelite St. John of the Cross. It was primarily a reference to the Pope as a man of profound and intense prayer. The late Carmelite Father Redemptus Vallerbeck easily identified with this. Like us, he was most moved during those private moments with the Polish pontiff, especially those early morning masses in the papal chapel. None of us would ever forget how the Pope would already be there when we arrived, kneeling in prayer, so totally absorbed in his meditations that he could often be heard to sigh.
real deep felt groan, thinking of his beloved church, all the problems that the church has to face in so many parts of the world, in so many of its sons and daughters. And certainly, when I hear the Pope groaning there, it really sends shivers up my spine.
We must also turn to God with prayers of petition, seeking from the Lord shelter and safety from the forces of evil, forgiveness of our sins, and healing of our wounded lives, strength to bear life's burdens, and grace to fulfill God's will.
And he showed the world just how broad his shoulders were. Not only did he attend to the weighty matters within the church, but he loaded on himself burdens that stretched far beyond the walls of the sanctuary of the Roman Curia. Pope John Paul II took on the immense challenge of trying to change the hardened hearts of oppressive dictators or uncaring government leaders. He made incessant appeals to silence the never-ending pounding of the drums of war. And of course, he did all in his power to stop the trampling of human rights, especially that which is most sacred, the right to life.
All human life, from the moment of conception and through all subsequent stages, is sacred. Because human life is created in the image and likeness of God. Nothing surpasses the greatness or dignity of a human person.
While fully aware his role placed him in a pulpit heard by all, Pope John Paul II was convinced, or rather he knew, that his greatest strength came not from standing at the church pinnacle of power and authority, but from humbly and faithfully kneeling in prayer before Almighty God. The appeals, the admonitions, even the threats of excommunication, none of these had anywhere near the force of, say, an hour of meditation before the Blessed Sacrament.
In the preaching of the Gospel, where merely a human enterprise, such challenges could easily give rise to discouragement. But just as the small group of apostles, sustained by the power of the risen Lord, was able to go forth with confidence to teach all nations, so the Church today, though deeply aware of the inadequacy of her human resources, perseveres in carrying out her mission with humble trust in the power of divine grace. In the Church, no commitment to the works of the apostolate, even the most necessary and urgent, can ever excuse us from the duty of raising our hearts and minds to God in prayer.
But in an age of exaggerated individualism, where religion is an extremely private matter, the Pope was adamant that prayer not be limited just to quiet contemplation. He believed deeply that the world needed to see people praying together publicly, Christians and non-Christians alike.
The world will think more of that big gathering in Assisi in 1986, October, the International Year for Peace.
Nigerian Cardinal Francis Arinze was head of the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue at the time of the remarkable prayer gathering in Assisi.
When the Pope invited to pilgrimage, to prayer and to fasting, representatives of all religions, Christian and otherwise, it has become almost a milestone.
A milestone for many reasons. Now it's become common to bring different religions together. Back in 1986, it was a novel idea, which prompted some Catholics to criticize Pope John Paul, but the Pope felt no need whatsoever to defend himself.
We are here because we are sure that above and beyond all such measures, we need prayer, intense, humble, and trusting prayer, if the world is finally to become a place of true and permanent peace. Prayer entails conversion of heart on our part. It means deepening our sense of the ultimate reality. This is the very reason for our coming together in this place.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread. Forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil.
Pope John Paul II's life of prayer was inseparable from his priestly vocation. Like his predecessors, he had a great love for the priesthood. As he often told his friends, "I am first and foremost a priest." And he would remind them how privileged he was to have this vocation, because it allowed him to preside at the Church's most important prayer of all, the celebration of the Eucharist.
The Eucharist writes the history of human hearts and of human communities. Let us reflect on all those who, being nourished on the body and blood of the Lord, have lived and died on this island, bearing in themselves, because of the Eucharist, the pledge of eternal life.
May God never permit to happen to me that I should lose his people. I pray to God to give me perseverance and to deign that I be a faithful witness to him to the end of my life for God. From the time I came to know him in my youth, the love of God and the fear of him have grown in me. And up to now, thanks to the grace of God, I have kept the faith.
And thanks there to Veronica Scaresbrick for that programme. You also heard the voice of the late Carmelite Father Redemptius Valabek and that of Nigerian Cardinal Francis Orinze. And that's all we have time for today. Thanks for joining us here on Vatican Radio. And don't forget you can listen to our programmes at any time by checking out our website on en.radiovaticana.va. That's en.radiovaticana.va. I'm Susie Hodges, and until next time, Laudato Jesus Christus.